Welcome to Business Spotlight on Muddy Radio WPSE. Business Spotlight is heard weekly at this time on 1450 AM and 107.1 FM. Today, Dr. Ralph Ford, Chancellor at Penn State Barron, sits down with Dr. Lena Zersko-Harned, Political Science Assistant Teaching Professor at Penn State Barron.
Welcome to the latest edition of Barron Talks, where we have discussions with interesting people in the Penn State Barron community. Today, my guest is Dr. Lena Zersko-Harned, a faculty member in our political science program. Welcome here.
Thank you very much for having me and considering me one of the interesting people on campus.
Well, you really seem to be at the nexus of some interesting conversations going in the world right now. We're going to get to that, but first I'm going to talk a little bit about your background. I'm going to read your bio here. You have a PhD and a master's in political science from the University of Pittsburgh, and a bachelor's degree in political science from Edinburgh University. And your research focuses on comparative politics, political behavior, and the politics of the post-Soviet space. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Well, why don't you do me a favor and just tell me a bit about your path to Penn State Barron. How did you get here?
In the word, luck. So Erie has been home to me for almost 20 years, more than 20 years. And I ended up in Erie completely by luck. In 1990s, when USSR collapsed, and yes, my accent is from that part of the world, American government decided to institute a program called Freedom Support Act. And as part of that program, they instituted so-called Future Leaders Exchange Program that focused on exchange students, or rather, one-sided exchange from the students, high school students from former USSR to United States. And I applied, competed, and won that scholarship and ended up in Erie, Pennsylvania, which I've never heard of before, right. But it has been my home ever since, on and off.
So was Erie selected for you, or did you have any choice?
I had no choice. A packet arrived basically telling me, here's where you're going, and I started looking it up, and I said, Great Lakes, why not?
Well, it is it is good that you came here and you ended up teaching our faculty. Was it something that you always wanted to do, is be a faculty member, a teacher?
I can say that teaching was necessarily a conscious choice. However, my choice to go in academia really has been something on my mind since relatively young age. My father and my aunts all have higher degrees. And the time when I was growing up again in the post-Soviet Ukraine, when the entire system imploded, lent itself to some very interesting questions, intellectual questions, that sort of guided me, prompted me to go on the path of studying social sciences and more specifically political science. Mm-hmm. So it was never really a conscious choice rather than a no-brainer. That this was something that was very interesting to me.
And you wanted to study how it works? And
absolutely. So anything that has to do with democracy, how it works, how it ticks, what are the institutions and constitutional arrangements, what is the role of the citizenry vis-a-vis the state and keeping state in check, all of these questions are very much at the forefront of all of my research.
And political science was driven by your experience going through and seeing the wrenching changes going on in society?
Absolutely, absolutely. So my book actually is one of the stabs at answering this question, or one of the hypotheses about what does it take for new democracy to take shape in post-Soviet space. So it was a labor of love of 10 years where my colleague and I attempted to find out whether or not the assumption that for democracy really to flourish in a society, a certain generational mental change has to take place. And we analyze specifically the post-Soviet generation vis-a-vis others to ascertain their democratic fervor, as it were, right?
Sure.
And it's very interesting for Ukraine right now because the new government in Ukraine is actually of that post-Soviet generation. So we kind of are seeing that hypothesis also living out in real time.
So what were some of your main findings then?
So a main finding suggests that, yes, post-Soviet generation very much different from the previous generations. And we attributed it to specifically to that experience of transition, right? So our post-Soviet generations are those people who were teenagers mm-hmm. at the time when, during the 90s, mm-hmm. basically. And we postulate that because of that socialization process, these folks are going to have a little bit more pro-market orientation than their Soviet counterparts, than their grandparents and parents. They're going to be more attuned to political participation. They're going to be more supportive of democratic governance, and they're going to be definitely more freedom-loving and more open-minded and more cosmopolitan. Mm-hmm. And we have found that to be largely true, but we also found that Russia and Ukraine went a little bit on different paths, and we also then proposed that the tenor and the length of the transition also has an impact on generations. So, for instance, in Russia, we can also speculate that sort of the stinted democratic growth is precisely because that democratization didn't go far, or that transition sort of fell flat in 2000s when Vladimir Putin became president. But in Ukraine, because there was more vibrancy in electoral process, that generation really was able to come more into its own as new democratic citizens vis-a-vis other generations.
You know, I was in the Czech Republic in the 90s, not too long after the Velvet Revolution, and I lived there for a mm-hmm. short period of time. But what I always remember hearing from all of my Czech friends was exactly this transition that was going on. But I will tell you, one of the things that they talked about a lot and I observed was they really felt that the Soviet state had left a lack of trust between people and institutions.
Absolutely.
And I could see that. It took so long to do things that you would normally do in a democracy, largely because they were checking everything out. Is that part of
that? That is absolutely the case. That is one of the very important obstacles for post-Soviet countries to overcome on their path to democratic governance, is that interpersonal trust, trust in strangers, and trust in institutions. And to some degree, I think the countries that have become members of the European Union post-transition had maybe a little bit easier way of it. However, big caveat there, because European Union has had its own, I dare say, adverse effects on some of those relationships as well. But in Ukraine, in Russia, the trust in bureaucracy is still at the very low level.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to take generations to build that
absolutely
thought process. And you know, the other funny story I will say is they also tell me about how a lot of Americans showed up early on just with this naive belief, and some of them frankly were con men, assuming that they were going to help this transition to democracy, and pretty soon found out it wasn't so easy.
Yes, absolutely. I remember those days too. We had quite a few NGOs coming across trying to do the good work. I actually wrote a piece about that for Georgetown International Studies Review that dealt with NGOs in post-Soviet Russia. And the biggest observation there is really that once you look at their message, idealistic message, let's say women's rights, right? The emancipation of women, it fell really flat in Russia in post-Soviet space. Why? Because women there have been emancipated for 70 mm-hmm. years of communist regime, right? Their concerns of women were very different, right? There is this concept of Soviet superwoman. She was supposed to be able to do everything, work, have children, take care of the family. So this was a very different dynamic than these American do-gooders expected to find.
Yeah. And I did hear a lot of stories about those who were there to help start businesses and teach mm-hmm. people the way of capitalism. So I'm sure, you know, anyways, that those days are long past. But the lesson is it's not an easy process. I wanted to switch a little bit. So,
of course,
as you say, you study, obviously, the Ukraine. And while what bigger place in the world where there's so much going on these days, whether what's happening between the Ukraine and Russia and the Ukraine and the U.S. But what is just fascinating, and maybe most people don't know, is their recently elected president, Volodymyr Zelensky. He was a comic. I mean, he was a comedian right up mm-hmm. until the time he became president. And he has this really interesting way in which he became president, which some people think is calculated. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting story. So, yes, Volodymyr Zelensky became president of Ukraine in April. He was inaugurated in May, May 20th. And little side story, my students and I were actually in Kyiv. We arrived on the 19th and we just happened to have a meeting on the 20th, just around the corner from where the president was being inaugurated. Wow. So we were able to catch his inauguration. It was a little cherry on the cake
so
of a travel
to
abroad.
Watch it.
Yes, we actually watched it. We actually watched him walk from his administration to the parliament building and to be inaugurated. So his story is quite interesting. He is a comedic actor. He has no experience in politics. He did have his own production studio that created many films, TV series, television shows, what have you. And he is perceived and argued to be a really good manager because he was overseeing mm-hmm. this whole production. And that argument has been posed as a counter, right, to the fact that he has no political experience, but he does actually has managerial experience and apparently a degree in jurisprudence. But his own response to this idea that he did not have any experience was, well, I will learn on the job, which of course, as you can imagine, got him a lot of pokes and jibes from the opposition. The interesting thing about Zelensky as president and his candidacy is that he won in the second round of elections against the incumbent with 73%.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
It is astonishing, and it is absolutely unprecedented in Ukrainian politics. Furthermore, his win is also stunning because for the first time since independence, Ukrainian election did not divide the country regionally. So what do I mean by this? That if you look at electoral map of every Ukraine's election, be it presidential or parliamentary election, because Ukraine is a parliamentary presidential system, right? So it has an elected parliament and elected president. Every electoral map actually shows Western Ukraine versus voting differently than Eastern Ukraine, right? So you have these very stark differences, right? So you have your blue states and red states in the United States. That was sort of the same presumed truism about Ukrainian politics, that West and East are actually quite different. In this particular election, there is no such divide. He won majority votes all across Ukraine.
He had a massive landslide election victory, and he was running against corruption. What explains why it was such a large win?
So Zelensky's rise to power is actually very interesting. As I argued elsewhere in one of the pieces that I wrote about this, Zelensky made a very clever electoral campaign. Yes, you're correct. One of the messages was fighting the corruption. And that message was very clearly communicated in All Things, a TV show that Zelensky has produced and starred mm-hmm. in as the main character, that is a high school teacher who becomes by accident president of Ukraine. And then he, in this role, Zelensky portrays this very likable, down-to-earth, yet very cerebral educated man who stands up to corrupt establishment. Right. And in my mind, that was a brilliant electoral campaign because public came already to associate him with this character. And the show was on the air since 2015. Right. So this was a long electoral program and it ran three seasons. Now, by the way, it's on Netflix, this show. It's called The Servant of the People, which incidentally, how Zelensky called his political party, a servant of the people. Corruption was a big theme in his campaign. But in terms of what really got him his big results was precisely because the population that voted for Zelensky was voting against the previous administration.
Yeah, it's to me, it's just fascinating to think, did he think that through several years ago and have this all planned out as, you know, this long-term plan to become president? I don't know if we'll ever know.
Well, I don't think we'll ever know unless memoirs come out at some point of time. But yeah, it's whether intentional or not, it worked out brilliantly.
But reality TV stars, it's not only something of the U.S., it's happening around the world.
No, not at all.
Well, let's take it to the latest discussion with what's happening in the U.S. As you know, the Ukrainian president had the infamous phone call now with our President Trump. And that's led to a whole host of things, including calls for impeachment hearings and the like. But you've also been put in the spotlight as well, or you've been in the right place at the right time with articles in Salon, the Houston Chronicle, Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And can you just tell us, you know, like what are you writing and what's your thesis and how have you ended up here?
So my expertise in weighing in on the Trump-Zelensky phone conversation really has been about the effects of that conversation for Ukraine. And there are consequences for Ukraine of this conversation. But I also have to tell you that in Ukraine, that phone call is no big news. It did not produce such a massive response as in the United States. And it makes sense, absolutely, right? Because for United States, this implies certain actions of the president that might be deemed as unconstitutional, etc. However, for Zelensky, this conversation really means a lot in terms of foreign policy and implications for Ukraine's, not only foreign policy, but for Ukraine's future and survival. Because let me remind you that Ukraine, since 2014, has been annexed by the Russian Federation. It has lost Crimean Peninsula mm-hmm. to Russian Federation. And since 2014, there has been a war going on in the eastern regions of Ukraine between the pro-Russian and Russian-backed separatist forces and Ukrainian forces. And Zelensky's another big promise, in addition to fight corruption, was to end that war.
Mm-hmm. One and stand of the, up to Putin as well, right?
And standing up to Putin, absolutely. So right now, the big conversation is precisely how Zelensky is going to be standing up to Putin. He had proposed of bringing United States and UK to the table, along with France and Germany that have been there all along in these negotiations with Putin. However, obviously, now United States is hardly going to be at the table, mm-hmm. right? There's questions about that. And in that infamous phone call, Zelensky made some very unflattering comments about both Emmanuel Macron of France and Angela Merkel of Germany, both of whom are quite important actors to give weight to Ukraine so it doesn't stand alone in front mm-hmm. of confronting Putin. So right now, Zelensky is faced with a very important decision. He is about to negotiate with Putin. There is a conversation about face-to-face meeting where issues and questions of resolving the war and stopping shooting, as Zelensky calls it, are supposed to be raised. But it seems that that agreement is happening on Russian terms, mm-hmm. that the Russian Federation is able to propose the kind of terms that are not particularly good for Ukraine. And Zelensky, whether it is by his own choice or due to his inexperience or precisely because he is now in a position of less power than he might actually think he has mm-hmm. facing this negotiation. And that is big news in Ukraine right now. There's been protests going on last two weekends on this topic.
Well, there was also concern as well that he was too closely tied to Russia and that his political backers in the campaign had connections to Russia. Does that play into the conversation?
So I'm not sure how much this plays in the conversation. Of course, it's a concern. Well, even though Zelensky himself has come out and spoke out against that criticism very loudly, He suggested that he's going to be continuing with the Ukrainian interest in mind and so on. But he did have interest in Russia and business interest, right? A lot of his films and projects were aired in Russia, were filmed in Russia. One of his associates is Igor Kolomoyskyi, Ukrainian oligarch who's also a questionable figure in its relationship, in his relationship with Russia. So it's on the back of people's minds.
Well, is it eroding his support then as president?
At this point, I think because Zelensky still enjoys such a great support from his followers, from his backers, it's really early to tell. However, the presence of protesters in the streets would suggest that he has opposition.
Yeah. This past summer, you took a group of our students to both Kiev and London as part of an embedded course. What did you do when you were there?
Oh, this was so much fun. This course was absolute pleasure to plan and to teach, and I'm very delighted that students are still talking about this. So this course was a brainchild of mine and Dr. Chris Harbin from the International Business, and it happened that we had both interest in European Union from very different angles. His from business, mine from nerd of political institutions, and of course democracy, lacks thereof, and so on. So I wanted to teach students the European Union, but in an interesting, dynamic way that they can really relate to. And what two amazing things are happening right now in the world? Well, Brexit, with unprecedented event where UK decided that they want to leave the European Union. And on the other hand, Ukraine, that trying very much to get in, right? For a number of reasons, and one of them, of course, being security and economic stability. And Ukraine just signed the association agreement, right? As a matter of fact, the Revolution of Dignity in 2013 was provoked by the government's at the time decision not to sign that association agreement. So we decided to look at it from the two perspectives, and that's what we did. We went to London and spoke Brexit to members of the European Parliament. We met with members of House of the Lords, with members of the House.
Really? Let me understand. You took our students and they met members of Parliament.
Yes, we actually spent 2 days in the Parliament. On the very first day when we arrived, we went straight to Westminster, walked through the gate, met with one of the members of House of the Lords, who actually served on Margaret Thatcher's administration during the Falkland Wars. He gave us a tour of the Parliament. We saw the session of the House of the Lords and House of the Commons. The very next day, we met with two members of the House of the Commons as well and discussed Brexit with them. One of them was Nick Bowles, who just at that time quit Tory party and walked away, was one of the first defectors, as it were. So we got to get his perspective as well.
Well, you have political pull. We won't even ask how you arrange that, but that must be a great, that's a great experience for our students. So obviously they learned something here they can't in a classroom.
Absolutely. They had a wonderful time. And of course, in Ukraine, they were able to attend a meeting with the ambassador of the European Union to Kiev. They attended class at Kiev School of Economics, and its honorary member, with whom we actually had dinner, Timofey Milovanov, is now Minister of Economics. So students actually had dinner with the new Minister of Economics of Ukraine.
Wow. And you know, the other thing that I always find fascinating is, you know, you remember your first trip overseas. So you take them to, it's like you took baby steps. So you go to London, which is very different, but still closer. And then, wow, what was it like when they landed in the Ukraine and saw just how different everything is?
You know, this was very interesting. I was very worried about this, honestly, because again, London, still English speaking, okay. But I think they were comforted in Kiev. Of course, it was very different, but they were comforted by the fact that this was my native city. So on the one hand, they could rely on my knowledge of the city and language and so on to sort of tell them, don't go to the left bank, don't go to across that street, stay over here, kind of thing. But they also impressed me with how eager they were to learn. On the first day, they learned a few words immediately to buy SIM cards for their cell phones. They mm-hmm. insisted of approaching the clerk and asking in Ukrainian themselves, which of course caused great deal of pleasure to me and the clerk. By the end of the trip, they were able to learn some of the basic thank yous, how are yous, good mornings, and so on. And another thing that impressed me was how omnivorous they were.
Mm-hmm.
I really worried that root vegetables might be a bit of a culture shock. No.
No, it was no problem.
No, not at all. Everywhere wow. we went, they asked, what do you recommend? And they ordered it and enjoyed it immensely.
So they didn't run for McDonald's when they got there.
No, they did not. And even if they did, they didn't do it in front of me.
So how do you know at the end that they really learned about Brexit and about the European Union?
So sneakily, of course, because this is still a course, they had to produce some kind of work. So they all had to write research papers. And what was also interesting that they were pretty thoughtful pieces that they produced upon their return, able to connect dots, making predictions. And quite a few of them wrote about Ukrainian experience in terms of what this new association agreement means for Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean for relationship with Russia? Many of them came out and said that they really wanted to know more about Ukrainian-Russian relations at the end of the day.
Wow. And so we would expect nothing less than they really have to show that they learned something. So that's what we do as educators.
Yep.
Well, let me ask you this question. So political science as a major and a field of study, we've got graduates who are doing wonderful things. It's just they go all over the place. We think about law and others, but what are some of our graduates do? What can they do with a political science degree, so to speak?
So, of course, there is a traditional path, right, that most parents expect when student enters into political science course. They think that their students or their children are going to be studying something about American politics. Inevitably, there's going to be law school, and they're either going to go and be a politician or else they're going to become a lawyer or both. And, of course, we have great success stories of that, such as our very own Congressman Guy Rothenschaller,
who mm-hmm.
is one of our graduates from a few years ago. So that is one path. Another path, of course, that's through any kind of public service, any kind of non-profit organizations. And of course, for the fields in international relations, there's great works to be had in diplomacy
mm-hmm.
and international organizations that have to deal with international law. And a lot of students expressed interest in that specific field. As a matter of fact, international relations and pre-law traditionally are the most sought after disciplines or sub-disciplines within political science.
So if you want to live overseas, this is a major for you as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Add a language to it and you're
Absolutely.
That much further ahead.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, one of the things that really interests me is, you know, the popular press, they, for better or worse, they call our students snowflakes. They're not able to talk to each other. They can't handle free speech. Does this match what's really going on? Are our students able to talk to each other about sensitive political issues on campus?
Well, funny you ask that, because as an advisor to Model UN team that has really sort of taken upon itself the role of the mediator of the big debates on this campus, it seems to me that our students are very capable of debating and discussing things with each other. I should say discussing rather than debating, right? Debating is a little different
mm-hmm.
Engagement process sure. than discussion.
Yeah. Discussion is good.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. What I see from Model UN team, which by the way does not only include political science students, I have quite a few engineers and scientists on that team, they are very eager to engage in conversations and discussions on a variety of topics.
Well, we're about to the end of our time, so is there anything else that you would like to discuss today?
I think we've covered a lot of ground here today, and it was my pleasure to speak with you this afternoon.
Well, thank you for joining us. This has been a fascinating conversation. My guest today has been Dr. Lena Sersko-Harned, and thank you for joining us today, again, from our Political Science Department here at Penn State Barron.
Thank you, Dr. Ford.
Thanks for listening to Business Spotlight on Money Radio WPSE. Join us again on Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. for an encore presentation of the Business Spotlight with Dr. Ralph Ford, Chancellor at Penn State Barron.